Morning, everyone. We're going to get started. First announcement, just to remind everybody about the Internal Medicine Conference, the update. Again, the residents and medical students are welcome to attend. Everybody else, please register so we can have a pretty accurate accounting as to how many people are attending. It's March 23rd, 24th, and 25th. It's at the Boca Raton Marriott on Military Trail. This morning, it's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Sean Baca, who is a rheumatologist here in practice. Dr. Baca went to University of New Mexico for his undergrad and also University of New Mexico for medical school. He subsequently did his fellowship in rheumatology at the University of Miami and also at Mount Sinai. Today he's going to give us an update on osteoporosis, which obviously is a really important topic that we all see every single day.
Okay, we got a few things to go through here. So anyway, I don't have any disclosures for this talk. So what we're going to do is we're going to define osteoporosis, we're going to discuss treatment and prevention, and then we're going to discuss controversies. And that's actually going to be the fun part, because everybody has all these different versions, and there's a lot of things that patients are talking about that are really incorrect, and we need to get this straightened out. So osteoporosis is basically defined as a compromised bone strength that predisposes one to fracture. So bone strength is usually measured in terms of bone density, which you can easily do with a bone densitometry, and bone quality, which is not so easy to measure because that has to do with interconnectivity of the bone, trabecular structure, et cetera, and bone turnover. So we can measure part of it. So realize that when you're looking at osteoporosis, your measurement or your osteoporosis measurement is a DEXA, which is not always accurate, but that's the best that we have to look and see who's at risk for fracture. So as far as the medical impact, basically the 10 million Americans have osteoporosis and 34 million have osteopenia, okay? One out of three Caucasian women will have an osteoporotic-related fracture at some point in their life, and one out of five males. So I challenge you to think how many women will get a heart attack, a stroke, a this or that. It's not one out of three. This is past an epidemic. I mean, this is pretty much almost the norm. And this doesn't have to be this way. But, we're not doing a great job in taking care of these patients. So basically, as we know, as age goes up, so does the risk of fracture. So you can see that generally what happens is that vertebral fractures start first, and then about 10 years later, you see this spike in hip fractures. So what they tell you is that a vertebral fracture basically is a sentinel event telling you that the patient is at risk for a hip fracture. Anytime you have a fracture, whatever your bone density is, you basically have four times that risk for fracture, based on just the previous fracture alone. So estimated at 2 million fractures per year in this country, okay? And these numbers actually haven't changed that very much. In fact, unfortunately, the fracture rate is starting to go back up in this country. Surprise, surprise. And Dr. Rubin and I know why, because the patients don't want to take their medications. Okay, but we'd had a steady decline in fractures for quite some time, and it's now going back up. Economic toll, about over 400,000 hospital admissions, 2.5 million office visits, estimated at $17 billion in 2005, and probably closer to $27 billion in 2025. And the number keeps going up. So hip fractures result in 38 to 36% excess mortality within a year, okay? Approximately 20% of hip fracture patients require long-term nursing care, and only 40% regain full pre-fracture level of independence. So it means if you're 80 years old, you have a 50% chance or better that you're not going to ever be the same again, okay? Mortality is increased also following vertebral fractures. And this is the most important thing to take out of this, is that mortality is higher for a hip fracture than the diagnosis of breast cancer, okay? The hip fracture mortality is 48% compared to 25%, okay? In 5 years, basically the mortality is much higher, and this is with age-matched controls, okay? So we are not doing our jobs. Vertebral fractures cause significant chronic complications also. People get arthritis, they get height loss. Dr. Lufti will tell you that they get a lot of restrictive lung disease, and then abdominal pain, and then, of course, other digestive issues. And, of course, the development of arthritis in previously fractured joints. So somebody breaks a hip or a shoulder, you know, you often will see that later on a high percentage of those people will develop arthritis, okay, and they'll require joint replacement later on, or they suffer with it. So this is just to give you an idea, and this is actually an older slide because I just told you this was 2 million. But this compares the risk of having osteoporotic fracture. And this is fracture. This is not osteoporosis. To the number of people who have breast cancer, heart attack, and stroke. So I just told you that you have a higher mortality in the fracture, you know, hip fracture group. You've got a higher mortality in the vertebral fracture. And you've got a number that's basically is about 6 times higher than this number. More people die in this category than in this category or this category. More people die from osteoporosis and breast cancer. And I'm not talking about just fractures. I'm talking about just the condition, okay? So what are the major risk factors? Of course, we talked about having a major fracture. So fractures beget more fractures. If you have a history of fracture in a first-degree relative, mom or dad broke a hip, you're at higher risk. Low body weight, smoking, steroids, and of course, the you know things that would put you at risk of fall, impaired vision, dementia, frailty, okay, and then of course early estrogen deficiency, premature menopause, surgical menopause without replacement of hormone therapy, and low physical activity, low calcium intake, and also alcohol intake. Now secondary causes get to be a little bit daunting, and this is what we'll do when we see a patient in the office, and we'll look at all these different things. But of course, you know, hyperparathyroidism is a big thing. You know, people getting too much thyroid medication, myelomas, you know, mastocytosis. It's interesting. I actually had a patient that had mastocytosis. I think, you know, I think Dr. Fernie may have seen this patient, and basically she kept fracturing even though she's getting medication. And the vertebroplasty and a biopsy showed that she actually had mastocytosis, had no symptoms whatsoever, no skin rash, no this, no that, and turned out to have systemic mastocytosis. So you get some very interesting things sometimes when people are fracturing. Of course, we know about you know, poor habits. You also have renal bone disease, which is not the same thing as osteoporosis, and also the genetic factors. You know, people that OGI, vitamin D resistance. And then, of course, rheumatoid arthritis, inflammatory conditions. And, of course, you know, GI-wise, you know, Dr. Blum will tell you about the celiac patients, IBD patients, inflammatory bowel. You know, they're not absorbing their nutrients properly. Often they also get steroids. And, again, even inflammatory GI diseases can put you at a risk of getting bone loss. And, again, just because the inflammation itself does that, affects your bone turnover. Medications are a lot of them. I want to highlight proton pump inhibitors. That's a biggie, okay? What happens with proton pump inhibitors is, remember your basic chemistry is that when you're pushing a proton this way, it allows you to push something else that way. So if you're not allowed to pushing hydrogen ions across, then guess what? You can't push calcium this way. You can't push magnesium this way. So remember, you see iron deficiency, calcium deficiency, magnesium deficiency, and vitamin B12 deficiency when you're on proton pump inhibitors chronically, okay? So that's something to look at. I'm seeing a larger number of patients come to the office with cramps now, muscle cramps, and you know what it is? It's iron deficiency. So, you know, I screen these people for iron, and we're finding very frequently that we find iron deficiency in patients who come in with just spontaneous cramping, especially legs and hands. And, of course, the biggies would be the chemotherapeutic agents and also agents that affect fertility and, of course, aromatase inhibitors. And also with males, you know, we're using androgen deprivating therapies for prostate cancer, which also puts you at higher risk. Steroids. What I want to show you on this slide, basically, is that even 2.5 milligrams of prednisone per day causes excessive amount of bone loss, okay? So they should be at zero here, technically. So even 2.5 milligrams, you can start seeing that the risk of fracture is at 1.5 times for vertebral fracture, okay? So it doesn't take much cortisone to get you in trouble. And you can treat people for GIO, and you can also do GIO, you know, prevention and get people on something early so that they don't have this curve. And basically 7.5 milligrams, you can see a big spike. Most of the guidelines will tell you that it's 7.5 milligrams that you need to treat, but look at that. I mean, you're talking about a number this big, but you still have over 2 times the risk even at 5 milligrams. So again, you know, the reality is that, you know, we should be thinking about everybody being on steroids should be on some kind of prophylaxis. Okay, so DEXA testing, who do we test? Okay, these are NOF guidelines. Okay, so anybody over 65 female and any male over 70, most males do not get screened, but all males are supposed to be screened over 70. We do a terrible job of this. Probably 5% of males in this country get screened, okay? Remember, the test itself is a $40 test. You know, so you're not talking about anything that's major, but most males don't get screened. And anybody over 50 basically have risk factors. So somebody's on chronic steroids, somebody has celiac disease, somebody, you know, who has rheumatoid arthritis, et cetera, premature menopause, whatever, you know, basically you may want to start even earlier. And females, I generally try to just screen them at the time of menopause, you know, so I get a baseline. So measurements of bone density, basically you all know this. Basically anything greater than minus 2.5 is considered osteoporosis, 2.5 is considered osteopenia, and anything better than minus 1. Now this is a standard deviation from the mean. Okay, so that's 2.5 standard deviations from the mean. So remember your statistics. So you're literally in the bottom 5 percentile when you have osteoporosis. So there's no such thing as mild, moderate, or severe osteoporosis. And when you see those in reports, it's nonsense. Because basically you're already severe because you're already in the bottom 5 percentile when you hit osteoporosis. Okay. So T-score, that compares you to an individual that has a normal, healthy bone age. So essentially what they do is they take a 35-year-old approximately, and they use that bone mass as basically the standard in which you want to be measured against, okay? So you measure an individual against the T-score, okay? But there's also something called the Z-score, which you'll see on the box next to it. And what that does is that measures you according to your peer group. So a Z-score is kind of like a growth curve. You know, when the kids fall off the curve, okay? This is the same thing. What you're doing is you're basically saying, okay, you're bad even for an 80-year-old. Okay, so the point is if you have that, that means you probably have a metabolic bone disease. Okay, so you're not following the normal curve. You're actually even worse than everybody else. So something else is going on. So remember the diagnosis is minus 2.5, but guess what? The diagnosis also includes if you had a fragility fracture and you're osteopenic. So if you're minus 2.0 and you broke your hip, you have osteoporosis. If you broke your hip and you weren't doing anything major and you're at minus 1, you have osteoporosis. Now, you know, maybe if they got in a major car accident, they fell off a building and they're minus 1, you might not think about it. But generally speaking, if you break something major, you have osteoporosis. And that's an indication for mandatory treatment, okay? What they may do this year is because insurance companies are very crafty and try not to pay for stuff, they may even change the definition of osteoporosis to include a positive Frax tool number. That's not official yet, but there's actually talk about doing that. If the Frax is positive, that's considered osteoporosis. Because remember, I told you the bone density is not the best measure of bone loss, but it's the only one that we have that's, you know, cheap and easy. So here are a couple of pearls. Okay, so remember the femoral bone density neck is most predictive of fracture for the hip. The Ward's triangle is not used, and it's still on the reports, but basically that's an old research thing. So you don't look at the Ward's triangle. And whenever you compare hips, you always compare totals to totals. You do not compare neck to neck. It's always total to total. Because remember, the total is an average of 3 or 4 different sites. So if you look at the total from 2015 and 2017, that's more accurate. Because sometimes you'll find that maybe the neck went up, the total went down. It's total to total. Lumbar spine densities, lots of false positives. Why? Because people get arthritis and scoliosis, and they get spurring, and all that stuff gets in the way of the beam. So if you have a minus 2.5 hip and a minus 1 spine, doesn't mean the spine's actually a lot better. It means that you probably just have more arthritis. And the other thing is you got to be careful to look at these scans because sometimes they have interventions. They might have metal in them. They might have cement in them or something. And sometimes if the techs aren't paying attention, they don't zero that out. You can do just 2 vertebral bodies on a lumbar to be valid. Okay, you can eliminate 2. Sometimes you'll see like L1 to L3, that kind of thing, if they've had any procedures or they have a fracture. And if you have a fracture, of course, that also makes it look better falsely, right? So follow-up scans every 2 years. You might do them more often, you know, once a year if you have a certain situation. Maybe you have bad hyperparathyroidism, high-dose steroids. You're considering whether or not you can change in treatment. You might do them earlier. And you cannot compare scans from different manufacturers. You know, you can't compare a Lunar to a Norlin to a Hologic. You just can't do it. You want to hopefully be on the same machine. The reason is because the blanks and the calibrators are different. So if you do a Hologic, you want to do it on another Hologic, and ideally you want to do it in the same machine. So when patients send me patients, I always insist they go back to the original scanner. I don't put them on my scanner. I put them on the original scanner, and I try to keep that going as long as possible. So as far as guidelines, basically, if patients had a previous hip or vertebral event, okay, even if it's basically morphometric, you treat, okay? Now, what does this mean? Two out of three vertebral spinal fractures are asymptomatic, which means you do chest x-rays on people, you see wedge fractures, and they'll never remember even having them. They're not always symptomatic. So that person should be treated. Minus 2.5 should be treated. And there's no such thing as, well, you're good here and you're low there, you know, therefore you basically don't treat. You're only as weak as your weakest link. So it's minus 2.5 anywhere the diagnosis is osteoporosis. There's no such thing as osteopenia and osteoporosis. You either have it or you don't, okay? Postmenopausal female, also, or male with a positive frax, okay? These are the groups that should be treated, okay? Now, again, I'm saying treatment. I'm going to talk about prevention now, okay? These are people that mandatorily should be done. So just as a show of hands, how many people are familiar with the frax tool? Okay, and how many people actually use it? How many? Okay, that's what I thought. So, all right, so this is a very simple thing. It's an online tool. You put it on your computer, and now that we all have EMR, I just keep my little icon, you close the window, open it up. So if you don't have it on the report, you can do it easily. And what it does is it tells you what the 10-year risk of fracture is based on several questions, which basically are associated with higher risk of fracture. So if you're greater than 20% for any non-vertebral fracture or greater than 3% for hip fractures, then you treat, okay? Simple as that. So this is what it looks like. You basically go to Frax Tool. It's a free thing. You put it in, you plug in all these numbers, and then you get out a number, and boom. So this person is 18 and 1.8, so technically this person would be considered low risk, and you would not treat this patient. Okay, so evaluation. So first thing, of course, is the history. You want to know about their medication history, the menopausal history, previous cancer treatments, radiation therapy, and then also parental history of fractures, history of hypercalcemia, history of kidney stones, fracture history, and fall history. Then you discuss lifestyle issues, alcohol, smoking, exercise, diet, and then again, this is a good time to do some patient education. You talk about fall prevention. Do you have slippy rugs in the house? Do you have grab bars in the shower? Do you think you should get some, et cetera, et cetera? The physical, basically, you want to look for height loss. You want to see whether or not they have a kyphosis, and then gait and balance. One good question, which is actually one of the quality measures for some of the quality measures, is basically you ask them if they can get out of a chair without using their hands. And if they have to push up with their hands, you've got a problem because they're more likely to fall. As far as testing, this is typically what I'll do for somebody who comes in for initial workup. We'll do a PTH level, vitamin D level, and it's a 25, not a 125, okay? And then a urinary calcium and SPAP, thyroid profile, cortisol. These I may or may not do because often the thyroid's already done somewhere else. And then bone markers, and then just typical electrolytes. This is very helpful because it'll give you an idea of the patient's nutritionally deficient, if they've got a metabolic bone disease, and that'll also help you guide your therapy. Imaging, you can do a lateral x-ray, look for fractures, and then also the DEXA machines, a lot of them have a morphometry software, so what they can actually do is they can actually look at the vertebral bodies and see whether or not they're squaring, they're actually becoming more pie-shaped. And if they are, then basically what you're talking about is somebody who potentially has had a fracture. And then you can also take that data and compare it to previous scans, and then you can tell whether or not the person is actually fracturing. Because remember, I said two out of three vertebral fractures are totally without pain. Okay, you just settle like a house sometimes instead of a boom, okay? And if you have a boom, you got to see Dr. Fernio for some cement. Okay, so male patients, special considerations. Hormone therapy for prostate cancer causes rapid bone loss, okay? And so any patients on androgen deprivation should be tested and followed regularly, okay? And at the very least, you start them on supplements, okay? And then you follow them regularly. If a male comes in with a low bone mass, all of them should get a testosterone level checked, okay? Doesn't mean you're gonna necessarily treat it, because there are lots of reasons not to use testosterone in males, but at least you need to know the information. And also, Remember, we recommend that all males over 70 should have at least a bone density, okay? Now, as far as prevention and treatment options, essentially the non-pharmacologic therapy we should not forget about. You know, fall prevention, assisted devices, weight-bearing exercise, balance, Tai Chi, that kind of good stuff. And also avoiding sedative medications increases risk of fall. And again, lifestyle modification. So recommendations for calcium. So if you're less than 50, basically it's 1,000 milligrams per day. Above 50 is 1,200 a day. And for males, it's basically pretty much the same, except that you're starting at 70, okay? So this is how you calculate, and you should have a copy of these slides, but basically you can calculate how much calcium a person takes in their diet easily by just using the rule of thumb, which is basically a dairy product is approximately 300, and a green vegetable is approximately 100, and then plus whatever's in your pills, add it up, and then there you go. Some people add 250 milligrams for, insensible intake, because even if you have a crappy diet, you're probably still getting a little bit of calcium in your diet. One thing to remember with calcium is that you're literally only absorbing maybe 20% of the calcium at most. So if you have a 1,200 milligram diet and basically you're only absorbing 300, and that's why it's important to look at the 24-hour urine calciums, because if they're spilling 300 or more, they're essentially spilling as much as they're bringing in or more, okay? Prevention, okay. Basically the same things. Now, estrogen and serums are pretty decent for prevention. What's important to know is that estrogen is no longer for treatment of osteoporosis. They took the indication away. It's only for prevention. So essentially the best thing to do is you have a postmenopausal female and you basically put them on some estrogen if they're a good candidate at the time of menopause. Because remember, at the time of menopause, you have that rapid bone loss, okay? And you do something about it. Well, what I prefer to do, if they can't, they're not an estrogen candidate, I'll suggest that maybe they should do 4 to 5 years of alendronate and take that curve that's going down and flatten it out. Because guess what? That patient probably won't need any treatment for anything as far as their bones until they're probably 70 if you do that, okay? So if you can do that, you can flatten out that curve. Okay, and then what you can do is you can also look for the high-risk patients with using the FRAX calculator. So the prevention is going to be based essentially on what your impression is of the risk, and the FRAX will help you with that. But at the same time, if you know this patient has been, not eating well and that both their parents broke their hips and blah, 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 this might be somebody you want to hit early rather than waiting, okay? And if they had a foot fracture, for example, or something else, even though that technically isn't an osteoporosis fracture, but you know that there are other things going on, you probably want to do a little preventive treatment early, okay? And at the very least, get them on the appropriate nutrition. So pharmacologic options, basically two flavors. You got anti-resorptive therapy and anabolic therapy. So anti-resorptive is basically are your estrogens, your hormones, calcitonin, bisphosphonates, and of course, your rank ligand medication, denosumab. And anabolic, we really only have one, which are the PTH analogs. We're supposed to get a drug this year called romosuzumab, but basically it's still being evaluated by the FDA because they have some concerns about it. And then sclerostin inhibitors, which are also not out. So essentially what the serums and the HRT do is they work on the estrogen receptors and they decrease bone turnover. Okay, they reduce the incidence of vertebral fractures by about 34%. And the Avista or raloxifene up to about 50%. Estrogen does not reduce the risk of hip fractures, does not reduce the hip fractures, okay, only vertebral fractures. And it is not approved for treatment of osteoporosis. Now, serums can be used for prevention and treatment, but not estrogen. Calcitonin, very weak. Basically, we used to use a lot in the old days, also it doesn't seem to have any basically good effect on the hips. It does have some interesting good effects if you have an acute fracture and you get so many calcitonin injections. It does seem to help with the pain a little bit. But this is really not a mainstream therapy at this point. I have maybe one or two patients that are on it because they just literally can't take anything else. The big advantage is especially with the nasal calcitonin and injections, you have no GERD issues, you have no GI issues. The big disadvantage, again, is that doesn't do anything for non-vertebral fractures. Bisphosphonates, big advantage is they're much lower in cost. You can get in multiple forms. You can get PRIV, and basically you can get monthly, weekly, daily, and even yearly dosing, okay? And you don't have the side effects of hormones such as DVT and hot flashes or risk of malignancy. The disadvantage is that you often see esophagitis and GI upset. They're not recommended for patients with renal disease, especially IV. You know, potential small risk of ONJ. The question of esophageal malignancies come up, and we'll go over that in a little bit. And noncompliance rates are very high. And, of course, you've heard about the low-impact fractures. And basically, the biggest thing is the Dr. Phil effect, is that, you know, patients are afraid of these drugs unnecessarily, and they all tell you that the boogeyman came after them when they took their first pill. But the reality is they're actually very good pills, and they work very well, and they're very safe. So special considerations, abandronate, okay, also known as Boniva, has never been proven to reduce the risk of hip fractures. You should not be giving abandronate, okay? There's really no reason when you have two other drugs, risedronate and alendronate, which do prevent hip fractures. So, you know, so there's really no reason to use this drug anymore, okay, in my opinion. As far as gastrointestinal upset, you can use the delayed release risedronate. You actually take this with food. So you take it once a week, and you take it after breakfast. So if you have somebody who has GI upset, this is actually a very good option for you. And believe it or not, because what they did is they put a coating on this, you actually have higher blood risedronate levels with the one with food than you do on the empty stomach, with the way they designed the pill. Just as a another pearls is that you literally with alendronate only absorb 0.5% of the pill and the best case scenario. So therefore, they got to have an empty stomach. They got to use tap water. They can't have other pills in their stomach, milk, juice, mineral water, blah blah blah. Okay, because they will not absorb it. Okay, this delayed release risedronate, you get up to 3%. Wow. And that's one of the reasons why probably people get the GI upset is because they have to go higher on the dose in order to get enough absorption to be significant. Oral therapy reduces the risk of vertebral fractures from 50 to 70%. 70% is routinely seen with IV zoledronic acid. Okay, you cannot use these in patients that have intolerance, Barrett's esophagus, or esophageal ulcers, or significant esophageal disease. It should not be done. Now, the problem with the LCD in Florida is that they don't necessarily mention GERD. And that could be an issue because sometimes I need my gastro colleagues to say, no, the patient can't have that, because a lot of times they come in, they want something else, but, you know, their insurances may mandate that they take the pill or they'd be intolerant to the pill. They won't just take a history of GERD. So sometimes you just have to write the prescription and say, try it and see what happens. So don't get mad at me. Refill compliance is a problem, and basically what this is trying to show you is that if you're 100% compliant with the drug, you have pretty good results. If you're 75% compliant, you already lose half the effect of the drug. So in other words, you got to be nearly perfect with these drugs for them to work. If you take it 50% of the time or less, you have basically no effect. No effect, okay, on fracture reduction. So they've got to be 75% or better, and ideally they have to be 100% to really see fracture reduction. After resort to the biologics, denosumab, okay, or Prolia, it's a RANK ligand inhibitor. And basically what it does is that it attaches to the osteoclast, and what it does is it prevents it from maturing, and it basically turns it off. It does not kill the cell. It just puts it to sleep, stays asleep for about 5 months. It starts waking up, and then 6 months you hit it again. So it's a very elegant medicine, and the nice thing is you do have a little bit of a cycling, and you do have a little bit of osteoclastic activity. So some people believe you should have a little bit for bone remodeling, and basically at the end of the cycle, it starts all over again. It's very easy to give and very low toxicity, but it is more expensive. And you can get a prescription for alendronate, you know, for probably about $10 a month. This is about $1,000 a dose, and you get two doses a year. Anabolic therapy, basically a teriparatide and now a abaloparatide. Biologics, the analogs of PTH. Now, what happens is that, you know, if you have unopposed PTH, basically calcium goes up and you actually shut off bone turnover. What happens if you give very small little pulses, daily pulses, what you end up doing is you actually increase the osteoblastic activity. The osteoclastic activity will stay up, but essentially you have more blastic activity to clastic activity, therefore the bone density goes up. So if you take these drugs, you can have as much as a 15% increase in spinal BMD at 18 months. So if you take alendronate in the same period of time, you're going to be lucky to see 1%. So essentially what you're doing is you're gearing up the system. And then essentially after that, then you can give them something else. You can typically only give them for 2 years, and then you stop. The biggest thing is that they have a rapid onset of effect. The abaloparatide is very interesting, is that it has a higher binding affinity than the teriparatide. And so you actually see higher spikes in the blastic activity, and you see less clastic activity with abaloparatide than with the teriparatide, which may have pluses and minuses, but you definitely see even more rapid increases in BMD with abaloparatide. You can see them you can actually see fracture reductions, and you can see bone density changes as quick as 3 months in abaloparatide. Now, the disadvantage is expensive. They run about $2,000 a month. It's a daily injection, and patients have to give themselves the injection. And basically, there's a warning of osteosarcoma. Basically, so far, there has not been an increase in osteosarcoma rates versus placebo. In fact, it's actually lower than the placebo rate right now. So this is really a non-issue, okay? The biggest advantage is that you can avoid the stomach again. So people are intolerant to medications. It's very easy to do. And we very briefly talked about this, is the sclerostin inhibitors and the cathepsin inhibitors. They're working on them. The last trial with this one was a problem that they saw a cardiac signal, so we're not probably going to get cathepsin inhibitors. And the sclerostin inhibitor right now is being held up by the FDA. But these are purely anabolic drugs. These will make teriparatide and abaloparatide look weak, okay? And these will be 1 year of treatment and you're done. And then you'll probably just follow them up with something else. Okay, so controversies. This is the fun stuff. Okay, so your usual patient comes in, they read, their Facebook or, you know, their SnapFace or whatever they're reading, and basically what they're looking at is they tell you, well, doc, you know, I saw this study and I'm not taking this because this is going to kill me. So one of the big ones is the calcium and cardiovascular risk, and I've seen the cardiologists being guilty of this as anybody else, is that they're telling patients to stop their calcium, okay? Now remember, I just showed you that little graph that shows you that more people are dying from osteoporosis and heart attacks in the first place. And so what you're doing is you're telling them that this stuff down here is more important than this stuff down here, okay? Secondly, basically there's absolutely no evidence that basically links calcium with or without vitamin D supplementation to cardiovascular risk in healthy adults. What the issue is that the calcification is a repair tissue. That's how the body repairs itself. So if you have a bad valve, you have a bad artery, you have a bad this, a bad that, you get plaque, you get basically myxomatous degeneration, and how does the body stabilize it? It calcifies it, okay? It is not the cause of the problem. It's a phenomenon of having the problem, okay? So that's number one. This all started because there was a paper in Australia and basically, actually New Zealand, and what they did is they said, you know, we see a cardiovascular trend. The problem is there have been a lot of other studies that basically have showed the exact opposite. There's a Japanese study that shows if you don't have any dairy in your diet, you're much higher at risk of stroke, okay? So there are other cardiovascular studies that show the exact opposite. Women's Health Initiative never saw anything like that. So you have basically, again, a lack of data. So you can tell patients that you're probably okay. Well, the proviso is if they have some kind of calcium disorder like hyperparathyroidism, that's a different animal. And some patients have hyperparathyroidism and osteoporosis. And I don't know if some of these people are throwing the study off, but again, if somebody has hypercalcemia, no, you don't give them extra calcium. You know, you address the endocrine issue. And those people may be at higher risk of getting vascular calcification, or people with renal disease who basically aren't taking their renal medications, especially the phosphate binders, are probably at higher disease. Okay, now, this is the other fake news that's out there, okay? Calcium and vitamin D do not reduce fractures in the elderly. Did you hear that recently? right? Okay, so the NOF came out with a statement just a month ago, and they basically talked about this study. And this is mostly for you guys. You know, when we were in training, we did this thing called Journal Club. And you sat down, and you had one journal article, and you would beat the crap out of it for an hour and a half. And you'd just look at the statistics and the data and the study selection, and you would all basically look and see, is this even a good study or not? You know, is this something I should be concerned about? Because what happens now is you live in this world where you got by about five lines on a screen, and then you just take whatever they say for gospel, and that's it. Well, you have your doctors now, and you have to have critical thinking. You have to decide and make decisions, and sometimes things are decided for you, not always correct, okay, especially when the press is telling you what to think. So essentially, the problems with the studies, they only looked at healthy community-dwelling people. So these are people in assisted living. They did not address the people that had osteoporosis. They did not look at their vitamin D levels, okay, and they were only treated for less than 6 months. So you're not going to see a fracture reduction if you're only giving people calcium and vitamin D for 6 months or less. Okay, but that was what was quoted in the paper the other day. Okay, so this is what the NOF decided to do. Okay, so in response to that, they basically, there is a significant risk reduction in fractures with calcium and vitamin D. Okay, so they did a very large study previously and basically excluded the patients who were already on supplements and excluded the ones that had previous fractures. So in other words, they already took out even the high-risk people out of this. So they're being intellectually honest and not just putting the sick ones in there. They're taking even the healthier ones in there. And basically what they did was is that they looked at adherence to the calcium and vitamin D. And basically, they showed there's a reduction in fractures by 16% and up to 32% for hip other fractures. So that is real-life data, and these are large studies, okay? And I quoted it underneath if you need to look at the reference. Now, the next thing is drug holidays. You know, patient says, well, I've been on Fosamax X number of years, and I need to stop it. Well, let's say their bone density is going up every year, and they're -3. Do you stop it? The answer is no, because what happened was is that people looked at the FLEX data, and the FLEX looked at a more general population, and basically what they said was is up to 5 years, you didn't see that there was much of a difference in fracture rates, whether they took it or not. But what they didn't look at is the people that got better versus the ones who didn't. So if you take the ones that are high risk, i.e. they've got a T-score of -2.5 or worse, they did worse when you took them off the Fosamax. So you're not supposed to take them off if they're high risk. You're supposed to leave them on. Okay? And so the ones you're going to consider a drug holiday are the ones who've improved. And then the question is how long of a holiday. And the average is anywhere from 1.5 to 3.5 years are probably average. I'm seeing a lot of people that have taken more of a drug retirement, and then they come to me like 8 to 10 years later, and they were osteopenic when they're in the Fosamax. They stopped it when they're -1.5, 1.7. They're going up from -2.2, and guess what? Now they're -3 because they haven't done anything for 10 years, you know. And so what happened, again, if they did their serial bone density testing, they would have been caught when they fell off the curve. But it seems like after about 2 to 3 years, you see a fairly rapid drop in bone mass, okay? So, you know, so again, you gotta follow these folks, and then you decide a holiday based on whether or not they're high risk or not. And you have other products, and this is really only, an issue with bisphosphonates. Now, the FDA recommends that you do not stop denosumab ever, okay? And that's because basically denosumab is out of your system in basically 5 months. The fracture risk goes up at 18 months, and essentially you're going to break if you don't, keep it up. So essentially after 18 months, the fracture rates will go back up. So the FDA is telling you two things. One is it's safe. And two is that you got to keep going with this stuff. The last bone meeting I went to, the doctor said, well, how long do you treat hypertension? You know, 5 years, 6 years, and then you stop? It's like, so why are we treating this differently? You know, this is a lifelong condition. So osteonecrosis of the jaw, okay? Most people don't know what it is. They don't know what the definition is, and most dentists don't seem to know either, okay? So, basically it's exposed bone. So you can actually see the bone. The gum is eroded. And basically it's unhealed for at least 8 weeks. And essentially, there should be no history of radiation to this area, okay? Because if somebody's had radiation, that's not the same animal either. Now, this is normally caused mostly by basically infections, okay? This is not a new diagnosis. ONJ has been described since 1850, okay? There was no Fosamax in 1850, okay? It can be seen with chemotherapy. It has been seen with steroid use, radiation use, and it's, most of them are seen after tooth extraction. And they're mostly in cancer patients, and they're mostly getting IV bisphosphonates. Because a German study showed 97% of them are basically a different animal. These are not your standard osteoporosis patients. There was a case report of four patients that came out of Florida, and actually one of them was mine. And that's what started the whole ONJ thing in the United States. My lady had metastatic cancer to her skull, and she was taking IV iridia at every month, and the usual dose is once every 2 months. And she lived actually with the metastatic disease for another 10 years. So she did really well with the drugs, but she did develop some substantial dental issues. So what's the problem? Is it the high dose medication? Is it the fact that she's malnourished, she's dying, she's got a chemo? You know, I mean, these people are a high risk for dental disease. But these things don't just happen spontaneously with the gum erodes. You usually start off with infection. So why aren't we just calling it a dental infection? I don't know, okay? So basically, in the studies, there were absolutely no cases of ONJ in any of the bisphosphonate oral studies, not even one, okay? And then there was two cases in the reclass study, okay? The zoledronic, one of them happened to be in the placebo, okay? So you're talking about very low incidence. So they're basically rare. The rates are anywhere from 1 in 10,000 to 260,000 to none, depending on which study you look at and whether or not they're associated with cancer. If you take the cancer people out of the equation, it's probably closer to 1 in 100,000. You know what the risk of getting struck by lightning is if you live in Florida? It's 1 in 120,000. So you're literally talking about something that's almost as likely to happen as getting struck by lightning. You know, true ONJ, okay? But everybody seems to have a neighbor that had it. How do you prevent it? Good oral hygiene, regular dental care. If the patient's having an extraction, we hold the drug. Okay, I'm going to have an implant or an extraction, then what we do is we basically hold it, and then we'll restart it when the dentist clears them. What's interesting is that, and you can find this reference, but there was actually a study in the 90s with Fosamax or alendronate, which said that if you had a dental implant, it was less likely to fall out if you're on alendronate, okay? So that gives you an idea of how controversial this stuff is. So this curve shows you the number of vertebral fractures, the number of wrist fractures, the number of hip fractures, okay, in the United States, et cetera. This is a worldwide curve. And the number of people that have had ONJ and atypical fractures. See that speck right there? That's what we're talking about. This is what's making all the news. And all these people are not getting treated. Okay, and this is just ridiculous. And again, there's breast cancer, stroke, murder, you know, et cetera. So we're talking about literally a speck, and no one has ever known have died of this tooth thing, okay? So atrial fibrillation, okay? What happened was is that there was some case reports with the zoledronic acid that 10 years after they started zoledronic acid, you seem to see a higher risk of atrial fibrillation. So this was taken very seriously, and it was adjudicated in 2008, and basically the FDA said there's no clear association between bisphosphonates and rate of serious or non-serious atrial fibrillation, okay? You know why they had saw more atrial fibrillation? You know what the highest risk for atrial fibrillation is? Being 10 years older, okay? That was it. Okay, but again, FDA being super cautious had this concern. Esophageal cancer, okay? So Dr. Rosenthal probably hears this. So there are cases of 23 patients in the U.S. who received a diagnosis of esophageal cancer, and they were on this drug. Now remember, if I told you that pretty much almost everybody is going to need this drug at some point, okay, what's the likelihood if your patient's actually going to see the doctor she's taking one of these drugs? You know, probably 80%, 70%, you know, if they're following the normal maintenance schedule. So everybody's on this drug. So if you have everybody's on a drug or breathing oxygen or driving a car and they have esophageal cancer, what's the chances that it's cause and effect? So anyway, in 2011, the FDA basically said it's not concluded that patients taking oral bisphosphonates have an increased risk of esophageal cancer, okay? But they do suggest that maybe, and this is an article, this is not necessarily, you know, written in stone, that doctors should avoid prescribing the drug to patients who have Barrett's disease and, and basically esophageal issues. But again, the cancer issue is a very, you know, non-issue right now. And again, compared to these other curves, we have to be careful. So what are the impediments right now? Well, the biggest one is per reimbursement. When I started, they used to reimburse $300 for a DEXA scan. They're down to $41 now, okay? It's a $150,000 machine that you have to have floor space for. You got to pay a tech to run it. And essentially, we're literally losing money doing them, but we've committed and we updated and bought a new machine and we've committed to doing them anyway, just like you use a stethoscope and you'll get paid for using it, but we've made that commitment. So that's part of the problem. NOF's been working for years to try to get reimbursement up. And you know, it's really a travesty when you think that, you know, you basically have, an excess of death, you have an excess of cost, et cetera, and you're not even paying for screening for these people. The other thing is that the treatment basically is staying flat, okay? In other words, only about 15 to 20% of people have osteoporosis are getting treated. That's probably closer to 70% in Boca, I think. But most places that people don't get treatment, okay? And drug reimbursement is also an issue. You know, you got prior authorizations for the better drugs. People don't want to take them. And then, of course, noncompliance, okay, which, you know, stems from lots of things, including perceived risk of these drugs. And everybody will say, well, yeah, but doc, you know, it's me. I probably will get struck by lightning, you know. So you have a lot of folks that basically just convince themselves that they don't need to take medication. I see that every day. Okay, so this is the bisphosphonate prescribing rates. They're dropping now, okay? So since about 2008 or so, you've seen a steady decline in people taking medication, even though the population's aging. That's a problem, okay? And that's a problem that we have to face. Now, less than a quarter of females basically were diagnosed who had a hip fracture, basically received any medication for osteoporosis within the year following the fracture. So when you're looking at that, if you have a fracture and we know that you go to the hospital or whatever, there's really no reason this person should not be started on treatment or referred for treatment, or at least you document the chart that you mentioned to the patient, because this, again, this is a quality measure. Okay, there's really no reason for patients at least not to be looked at. And then they did an analysis of primary care doctors, and primary care doctors aren't doing any better job. Okay, anywhere from 38% to 62% actually order regular testing. We're not talking about treatment, we're just talking about ordering testing. Okay? So what are the conclusions? We've come a long way in osteoporosis treatment. When I started, we had zero drugs. Okay, now we have several that are available. You shouldn't forget prevention, early treatment, which includes exercise, you know, all the the pharmacologic things, maybe consider treatment around the time of postmenopause. It has a significant morbidity and mortality. Okay, the numbers dwarf breast cancer death rates, heart disease, and we're not reaching most patients who should be treated. Every patient that leaves the hospital, basically who has an old fracture or fragility fracture, should have their osteoporosis treatment reviewed with a notation in the chart that follow-up treatment is recommended, okay? All right, because you got to put it back on them if they don't get treated, you know, because otherwise it looks like you're the one who didn't do it, okay? Lack of government support and public awareness basically is causing us to make recessions now, and basically, we have a negative public opinion versus about side effects and benefits, and we're undermining most of the gains that we're making. Drug holidays are detrimental to patients who are at high risk for fracture. Okay, noncompliance, big issue again. And basically, again, education of your patients, which is a pain in the butt because you got to take another 10 or 15 minutes out of a scheduled visit to basically talk to them, and that's part of the problem. And then there's no compelling evidence to suggest that calcium increases the risk of cardiovascular disease. Okay. All right, questions? Yep.
Your slide has the calcium being a low risk
Well, in a, well, the bottom line is that the low risk is, oh, you, okay, so there's two questions. What you're saying is that adding calcium to somebody who is not at high risk, the problem with that is that you're basically taking somebody who's unlikely to have a fracture and then testing them, so you're never going to find anything. So essentially, if they're healthy, I would still follow calcium recommendations, you know, and because, you know, you could maybe see if they don't, you know, but again, you got to at least follow their bone densities and see what's going on. As far as the cardiac patients, there is no compelling evidence that it causes coronary heart disease, period. Okay, so, you know, a healthy patient should still be, you know, get the proper nutrition. But, you know, I assume that they're healthy. They're probably the reason why they're healthy. They have better genetics. They're probably exercising. They probably are getting in their diet one way or another. Well, yeah, the general population, yes. But again, I'm not including people with hyperparathyroidism or other things. Those people, I think, is a special consideration. You know, but again, you know, that's not an impediment to taking calcium and vitamin D.
And a quick second question.
Yeah.
Why isn't the thoracic spine included? We get a lot of T10 to T12 fractures. Why don't we include the lower thoracic spine?
Just convention. They just decided never to do it that way. I mean, it's you know, remember, all rules are decided by a bunch of old men getting in a room and deciding what they're going to do. I mean, you know, that's a, they just decided to look at that. Okay, the lady in the back.
Can you comment on the type of bone that builds?
Well, see, that goes back to the issue is that, you know, we talk about bone turnover. If you take something like the teriparatides, you basically are growing back regular normal bone. Now, when you take a bisphosphonate, if somebody has already broken all this trabecula, you don't necessarily grow it back. What you'll do is you make this trabecula thicker. So, you know, what I would like to do with patients like that, especially in their minus 3 range, I'd like to treat them with an anabolic drug first because that lays down more collagen, okay? And then I'll try to basically give them a bisphosphonate following that. So, you know, that's really the big issue in terms of low-impact fractures. But, again, I just went over the fact that they're so incredibly rare, and low-impact fractures can even be seen in placebo group that, again, you know, it's unknown. But the bottom line is that, you know, the newer agents will probably be better, and ones that allow some turnover are probably better. Like, for example, even when you use the denosumab, towards the end you start getting more cyclic activity. So maybe that cycling is a good thing. You know, maybe it's not good to have just pure anabolic or pure anti-resorptive activity. Ken. Yeah. Well, the other thing is that that could be also a sign of poor lifestyle. You know, alcohol, et cetera. Jeff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when we're looking at that mostly in a community hospital, you're really looking for tumors and cancers and myeloma and that kind of stuff, you know, the, like that mast cell gal. But in terms of, like, actually doing, a bone biopsy, you can't really get that information from that because that's something that has – those are usually experimental kind of things, and they have to actually be they have to include cortical bone, so they're usually taken from the pelvis or hip. So in terms of, like, looking at it to analyze the bone, you know, like a bone biopsy because a person has renal bone disease or something, that has to be done the old-fashioned way with the trocar and the hip. So really you're just getting pathology for the most part. You can't really use the mineral part of it. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, you know, and I guess the question is the protocol. I think that if they, especially if they've had more than one fracture in a period of time, it definitely should get a, you know, biopsy. It hasn't been done at some point because, you know, your yield is going to go up. Goal is basically want between 30 and 60 is about right. Okay, Mike. Right.
And the four major areas that came out was
Mm-hmm. In general, it's still probably one of the safest classes of drugs, misproven, and it's probably untrue.
Well, what I tell the patients to do is just take calcium citrate. And then that basically negates our issue as far as the calcium absorption, because the carbonates may not dissolve as well without the acid, but I just tell them to take calcium citrate or calcium malate, and that takes care of the problem.
Exercise, you mentioned that it would prevent it. I'm good at the death, and a lot of librarians don't break bones.
Mm-hmm. Well, typically they like to recommend weight-bearing exercise, but to be honest, I don't think I've ever really seen a great study in swimming versus this or versus that. They did one in walkers versus runners, and they found that just standing up is probably good enough. You know, you just got to be active and move a little bit. So they didn't find a difference in BMDs between walkers and runners. But the problem with all this stuff is that you're looking at, you know, 12,000 variables, because, you know, people walk and run probably more like take care of themselves, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, again, just like the PPI issue, you know, maybe, you know, part of it is that they didn't, you know, scrub out, you know, other things, the cardiovascular issues. Again, maybe it's like the AFib, they're just 10 years older, so therefore you're going to get more dementia in 10 years than if you, you know, and then pretesting. So, you know, sometimes these things get a bad rap. Well, the issue really is not that. The issue is how long does the bone density stay up? And essentially what they're saying is that it depends on the patient. If the patient started at minus 2.5 and you brought them up to minus 1.8, they probably will maintain a bone density for up to 5 years, okay? In my experience, about 3 years after they stop, you start seeing that drop. You know, and again, if you just follow them with bone densities, you'll do something. But don't be surprised when their bone density starts dropping. So if they're -3, you don't stop, because again, the chances of these other side effects is a speck on that chart. You know, they're not gonna, the patients aren't gonna believe it. Or you can change them out to something like denosumab, which is potentially cycles, but you should not stop treating them. Okay, anything else? Good. All right, thanks.